Hello, everybody. This is Steve Smith at WCG Patient Radio. WCG is a company focused on the ethical, safe, and efficient conduct of clinical trials for the benefit of patients seeking treatments for unmet medical needs. We're speaking today with Dr. Gregory Hall about his new book, Patient-Centered Clinical Care for African Americans, and his career as a physician with considerable insight into health disparities that impact African American communities, and his commitment to developing solutions that engage patients, communities, and medical schools, and his work to bring more African-American physicians into medical practice. Hello, Dr. Hall.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Good, thank you. You are an internist with a practice near Cleveland in Northeast Ohio. You've written an amazing book that I want to ask you about, but first, tell us how it is you came to be a physician in the first place, and what gave you an understanding of minority populations?
Well, thanks for the opportunity. People frequently ask me, you know, how did I want to become a physician? And I frequently say there wasn't a moment that I remember in elementary school. You know, I was a person with a briefcase, and I used to wear an oversized white shirt because that was going to be my lab coat. And I used to play, in a good way, play doctor, right? I wanted to be a doctor when I grew up, and I sort of followed that course sort of all the way through. In elementary school, junior high, I chose my college based on its admissions rate for medical school, and so it was sort of a path that I was sort of always in. Once I became a physician, and I trained at Cleveland Clinic, and I always said I was going to come back to the urban neighborhood where I grew up in Cleveland, and when I did that, finished residency, I decided to volunteer and volunteer with our local development corporation and then with the city of Cleveland. And then I got recommended to be appointed to this Ohio Commission on Minority Health, which was the first commission for minority health in the country over 30 years ago. And so they needed someone from Cleveland, and so they appointed me. And I didn't know what the Ohio Commission on Minority Health was, but I went anyway. And then through the years, I ended up being the chairman, and I needed to give a chairman's report every month, actually every quarter. And in that report, I'd go online and look at health disparities and sort of see what were some interesting facts. And then I basically determined that what I believed about minority outcomes and whatnot, was not necessarily true. I believe that all minorities had bad health outcomes, and majority of white people had good outcomes. But if you look at life expectancy, the average life expectancy for African Americans is 74. For whites, it's like 76, 77. For Hispanic Latinos, it's 82. And for Asian Pacific Islanders, it's almost 88. And so I was shocked, because I would have assumed Hispanic Latinos and Asian Pacific Islanders would have been on the one end, and then whites at the other end. So once I realized that the problem, was principally an African-American problem, I began to sort of spend more time researching ways that as a physician I could improve things.
So your book is very relevant to this topic and to this time that we're in right now, in which the general public has seen in the headlines regarding this disproportionate impact of the COVID pandemic on African American communities. And along with that story came the news of these underlying health disparities that always exist, which gave COVID the opportunity to really attack in those communities. Tell us about your book and what can we find in it about these things?
Well, as the journey came, as I prepared those sort of monthly presentations or quarterly presentations for the commission, I found more and more little pearls in terms of differences in the treatment. Like, I naively believed that providers or physicians didn't contribute to health disparities. I thought it was just poverty and lack of insurance. I didn't know that actually providers contribute to it and hospital systems contribute to health disparities. And so as I found more differences that in the clinical care of African Americans, and was almost shocked to find some of them that I hadn't been taught them or exposed to them as an African American physician with a 90% African American population, I thought, this is like, I can put together some clinical pearls that providers will actually like. We, you know, providers don't want to propagate health disparities. We want to correct them. But if you don't know that you're doing something not in the ideal way, you can't fix it. And so the book, in a practical way, talks about approaches to cardiology differences, pulmonary lung differences, kidney differences. You know, each chapter sort of takes an organ system and outlines, you know, just the little nuanced differences that occur that can lead to better outcomes. And then also one of the main points I really felt I needed to make with the book was to let the providers know about the bias and trust issues that a lot of African-American patients just don't like providers. They don't like the medical establishment. And some of that goes back to the Tuskegee syphilis study. But, you know, as I did more research, I found that, you know, where medical schools got their cadavers, got their bodies for dissection, is they would go to poor and African-American graveyards and dig up freshly buried bodies. And so that was a practice in the South and in the East. And then African-American family, imagine losing your wife or your husband or your child or your mother, burying them and coming back a week later to visit the gravesite, and someone stolen the body, and you know who it was. It was the medical school in the town or the medical school in the next town. And the medical students were the ones that needed to do that. So aside from, you know, the history of you know, the medical experimentation with slaves and then grave robbing and then the syphilis study, and there are other stories about, you know, basically how the medical establishment has kind of slighted African Americans over the last 400 years, it's developed sort of some foundational distrust in that community that current physicians have to really work to try to reverse. But if you don't know about it, you can't even address it. And so there are many physicians that I've met have come from places where people love doctors. You know, where I come from, my family loves doctors. You're a doctor, you're the highest, most revered profession. But if you come to an African-American person, that you've got a 44% chance of them thinking very little of you, not just having you be the highest, but have them think you almost of the lowest. And you've got to try to rebound back from that. So the book talks about, I want to emphasize for the clinicians, it's for providers, that this clinical pearl so we can improve our care, but it's also sort of sets the stage for why there is a lot of the distrust.
And what should the medical community do differently to connect better with these patients and to establish trust?
Well, it's important to just acknowledge it. I mean, there were people, I mean, I was explaining to my kids who are in their early 20s that, you know, 20 years ago, people didn't acknowledge that there was health disparities, or that one group was treated poorly, or that there was racism, or that there was oppression. They people just didn't acknowledge that, right? And so now we're at the point where, you know, 90% of people acknowledge that there is racism and that there's oppression and that it's wrong. And that's come a long way. And so we need to do the same sort of thing. We have to acknowledge that the medical establishment has done African Americans in general wrong over the last 400 years. And that you're going to run into some people who still hold a grudge for that, who still don't want to trust your advice, or think that you have some other ulterior motive in what you're suggesting for them, or think that you're profiting inappropriately from your medical care. And you just have to sort of acknowledge that and say, and sort of dispel it, that's what's in the room. It's not true. I'm doing that. It's not true. I want the best from you. And then you have to spend a little time building trust, you know, just spending some time finding out about the patient. When I teach the medical students and residents, I tell them, I make a point of not getting to the point. So I go in and find out, what high school did you go to? What part of town did you grow up? Or if you came from another town, tell me about that city. And, oh, I visited one time. Just to have a conversation so that you can just start to sort of break down the barriers that are naturally built between a professional and, you know, and a provider. And there are things that they can do. Sit down. You know, there are a lot of doctors that stand through a visit. And so by sitting down, you show that I'm here for you for a moment. It's just like simple things that you can do to sort of try to help, you know, build better trust.
And is this trust also, issue also between patients who are African-American and African-American doctors?
Yes, absolutely. That trust issue, it goes across races. It doesn't matter. I have to build trust with my patients that I frequently will go into an exam room and the person's looking at me mad. And before I knew about this, I would look and say, why are they mad at me? I just met you. I haven't done anything. And then once I found out, oh, this is a thing, and it's a pretty pervasive thing, then I basically pull my schmooze out and really start to kick in, you know, because I know I've got to spend a little bit more time, but that on the back end, if they see that I'm trustworthy, you know, and then they start to break down, and then I'll have a shot at getting them to, you know, maybe take some medication or understand the diagnosis or get a follow-up or whatever.
Are health disparities only in low-income minority communities?
No, and this is the topic of a number of issues. When we talk about, I'm on the Board of Health for the county that I'm in Northeast Ohio, and we are poised to declare racism as a public health problem, right? And that racism is not saying racism toward poor African Americans or toward poor Hispanic Latinos, but it's in general, you know, just sort of this wide sweeping oppression and racism and discounting. And so that pressure is what they say is causing that high infant mortality when in African Americans, regardless of their socioeconomic status. And so a woman with the highest, an African American woman with the highest socioeconomic status is still going to have a higher rate of infant mortality than a white woman in the lowest socioeconomic status. And so it's not according to poverty, it's according to race. And we see that also with, referrals. I mean, there's a lot of data that I looked at when putting the book together that when, you know, the odds of being prescribed a medication for hypertension or after a stroke or to prevent a stroke or to lower cholesterol or to treat dementia, all those odds are all lower. And it's not just in a low socioeconomic status, it's just across, it's by race. And so as an African-American male, I'm less apt to get the treatment for an urgent stroke or, you know, things of that nature. And so, and it I don't think it's done intentionally, but it happens. And so you can't reverse something unless you're intentional about making sure it doesn't happen, right? And so I think that's just sort of making people aware that you are making those little decisions that are impacting outcomes, even though you're doing it in, you know, sparingly, it overall it can really impact.
I know experts have talked to us before, including on this podcast series, about what you've also talked about in your book, this concept now of bias, and this also concept that if people aren't going to the doctor, perhaps because they don't trust, then they're also not. By the time they show up, their health problem has advanced too far compared to people who regularly go to the doctor. So there are these different common themes that are coming up. What about genetics for African Americans? Is that also a possible cause of health disparities?
Yeah, there's definitely genetic issues in African Americans that impact outcomes. I mean, I felt that they've identified the genes related to kidney disease and premature kidney disease, and mm-hmm. You know, the odds of being on dialysis and things related to salt sensitivity and thrombosis. And so they've really looked at ways that, you know, when people go on warfarin or for anticoagulation, there are just genetic differences in African Americans that they require a higher dose. And they've even said that, you know, Asian Americans require lower doses for like cholesterol lowering medication, things of that nature. Salt sensitivity seems to be genetic in that, you know, if you're in, you have African heritage and you need to be able to conserve salt for an extended period of time because you're in a hot arid region. And so the genes for people who are able to conserve salt, you know, that's a positive sort of outcome in people in that area. So, but once you migrate to North America and you have this salt-saving gene. Now it's leading to increased hypertension, increased kidney failure, and things of that nature. So there are some genetic differences, like sickle cell or cystic fibrosis. I mean, there are going to be genetic differences or increased risk for colon cancer. And so those things are there too, but you also want to be able to be aware. I tell my residents again, when I was in medical school, we learned about Ashkenazi Jews, right? They have an increased risk for breast cancer and colon cancer. And so if you see that one, you want to make sure you screen them. And so I a year ago, I got a lady who was 55 and came in, she said she was an Ashkenazi Jew. I was like, oh my God, I've been waiting for you my whole career. Because then she hadn't had a mammogram and she hadn't had a colonoscopy. And so this is the pearls for African Americans, the same thing. There's an increased risk for prostate cancer. There's an increased risk for colon cancer, increased risk. There's a decreased risk for breast cancer. But if you get breast cancer, there's a way increased risk of it metastasizing sooner and being far more aggressive and being resistant to treatment. And so those things that, you know, providers need to just be aware so they can kind of proactively screen, you know, sort of as needed.
So that brings up the very interesting aspect of clinical trials participation. The FDA issued guidance back in 2015, and it's a theme there too for in advising pharmaceutical companies who make clinical trials to that they should be making them more diverse, more inclusive, because of these genetic differences. That if you're just testing drugs on Caucasian males from middle and upper incomes, you're not going to be getting drugs appropriate for all these different ethnic groups because they respond differently to drugs and disease. So what about African American participation in clinical trials? Can you tell us your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you are absolutely right. I mean, as they've done clinical trials with African Americans, they almost always see, they frequently see differences based on race in outcomes. Either in control, like, you know, there's a specifically different set of medications that we use in hypertension, for example, in African Americans versus what you would use in a white American. And so knowing that basically there was a clinical trial that determined that. Otherwise, we were still giving the wrong medications to African Americans and wasting the time it took to control hypertension. And so having these clinical trials, it's really unveiled a lot of information that the providers could use to their advantage and to the patient's advantage in terms of making them, making them better. And I think, and then the issue, some of it is just not being around when these trials are done and not also feeling that you're properly protected. You know, the issue with the Tuskegee syphilis study is that there was no one on the patient's side. You know, there was no one advocating for the patient. And so I think, you know, having a situation where the patient feels like there are protections in place, that these people aren't really experimenting, although, you know, to a certain extent we are, you know, but really that there are protections in place that will make sure that it's safe and that they can trust that. And like I said, and then also just knowing about it, just if you can't refuse something if you don't know it. You know, if you don't even know it exists. And so a lot of African Americans just aren't aware of the opportunities to be involved in clinical trials.
Yeah, so this gets to the concept that is brought up by other experts in this these issues, that there should be, it would be good if there were more physicians in communities that are in contact with those African American patients who would also then invite them to clinical trials. And this makes me think of the institute that you're starting, the patient. Tell us about the African American Health Institute for African American Health and the patient advocacy aspect of it.
Oh, thank you. Well, the Institute for African American Health was basically fundamentally set up to mentor the next generation of physicians and to, find ways to help them get into medical school. Right now, between 4% and 5%. Of physicians in the United States are African American, as opposed to the 13% population. So that's significantly lower. And, you know, being able to navigate the difficult path it is to medical school, you need support systems. And so what a lot of times, you know, people that have more money or they have access to tuition, or they have access to a number of things where they can determine how do I get into medical school. And so I think it's our institute is supposed to primarily be working towards trying to make sure that we can help them answer questions that they have related to getting into medical school. One of the ways we're going to help pay for that is by doing the patient advocacy aspect, which is where we're going to have experts in different specialties review disputes with patients. If patients have a dispute with the quality of care that they were given, or if there's issues at the hospital or issues with the provider or issues with communication, then we would be able to review those cases and actually advise them if there are issues related to bias or issues related to inferior care. You know, there's some people that just don't believe they need to read anymore. And they, you know, they're not interested in learning more about treating African Americans, even if they have a significant African American population. And so this patient advocacy aspect is going to work deliberately to try to educate providers and educate patients so they can sort of help defend themselves in situations like this.
This is very inspiring that you are this level of experienced with this population that needs change and needs this kind of help, and are not only treating them as a physician, but you've come up with the institute for them. You mentor young folks to get into medical careers, and then medical students to get through successfully. And you've even put it into a book. So we're really pleased you talked with us today, Dr. Hall. Thank you for spending time. I'm sorry we don't have more of it.
No, I really, really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Steve.
This is WCG Patient Radio. We've been speaking today with Dr. Gregory Hall, the author of Patient-Centered Clinical Care for African Americans. Special thanks to our executive producer, Lauren Osmore, and our technical team, Isabel Andresen and Roxana Guilford-Blake. Special thanks to our technical director, David Fogel, and head of studio, Amy Hutnick. Goodbye, everybody.